This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. May is Asian American and Pacific Islander, or AAPI, Heritage Month. And today we're talking about the history of Asian communities in the U.S. as well as here in Indiana and why this history is still relevant today. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us now is Rupal Thanawala, the president of the Asian American Alliance. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about May. It's an important time for the AAPI community. And how is the Asian American Alliance planning on celebrating this month?
So in a normal year, we could have many events throughout the month. But for this particular year and even the previous year, the way we have scheduled the month full of celebration is talking on shows like yours or speaking to media and many corporations and organizations to talk about Asian American history in the United States, particularly in Indiana, and what is the current state of Asian Americans in our community. Then we also talk about stereotypes, minority myths, and the discrimination. It's very important for us to talk about it based on what has recently we've seen in last 15 to 16 months and some of the escalated violence in last few months. So we're talking about that. And the third thing we are really talking about is, you know, our cultural competency, sharing our culture with our who's your friends. So it's a lot of things are done virtually, and we are hoping that next year will be a little bit more in-person celebrations of our culture, history, arts, music, and heritage.
Right. And so what are some of the parts of the Asian experience in history that you think it's important for people to know and learn about this month? I know you said some of the stuff you're talking about is perhaps stereotypes or things that have happened. So what are some of those examples?
So Asian Americans, migration goes back into 17th century, and we have been here for probably more than 200, 300 years. Of course, some of the recent migrations have been more from different countries, but earlier they were from China, Japan, India, Korea, Vietnam over the years. But then we also want to talk about the stereotypes that we have. So although we have been here for so many years, it's been really thought about that, oh, you know, Asians are recent migrants. And, you know, they are not even Americans. That's a one stereotype. Another one is they are good at math, science, and some of the STEM careers. So that's another stereotype that we constantly face. Our film industry and our entertainment industry often portrays Asian American women as just a sex worker or somebody who is in a call center. And you would see an Asian man as like a kung fu fighter or somebody who is a cabbie from New York. And these are the stereotypes we all the time face. However, we also want to say that, you know, Asian Americans are embedded in an entire community. We have my own son is in Army. We have so many teachers, doctors, scientists, but then we also have individuals in all parts of the community who have been living here for probably more than 100 years and longer, particularly in Indiana. And I know my friend Nicole is going to talk a lot about that later in the show. So we want to make sure that we are Americans, and particularly some of the hate crime acts that happened recently was also targeted as women as a two things I want to talk about. One, what happened in Atlanta, and one, what happened in FedEx. In Atlanta, I suspect it was mostly because women were looked as a sex object. And what happened in FedEx is that Asians are taking away our jobs. So these are the classic examples of how it can manifest and be harmful to Asians when those stereotypes are there in the community.
How frustrating is it to constantly have to prove Americanness? You know, I know you mentioned you like your son's in the Army, but it's like you shouldn't have to tell people that, right? You know, how does that feel on a personal level for you?
At a personal level, it is very frustrating because I always say one thing that we are Americans who are proud of our heritage like any other individual should be, because America has immigrants coming here for the last 400 years. I look at my friends and they said, hey, you know, I just did my genealogical research and I found out I'm half Irish, and that's great. Let's celebrate our culture. So why can't they see us with the same lenses that we are Asian Americans who have come here? We have embraced the culture and the we are patriotic Americans. And how can you see us anybody who is different than you? Mm-hmm. And we are not given the privileges or the and then I can talk about later about some of the other discrimination that happens in the workplace and even in the community. So it's very frustrating, and it becomes harder as parents to how do we effectively teach our children and that they don't see the, but at the same time, we don't want to create any unwanted bias in their mind also that, you right. know, once you go out, you know, you can't make friends or anything. I had one kid come and talk to me. He's a third grader. And he says, I was getting straight B's. And my teacher said, I know you can do better. You're an Asian.
Oh, wow.
So as a parent, it can be very frustrating that how do we make sure they're trying to make our children as raising this normal American child. And they feel something like this in the school system also.
Right.
So
right.
as a parent, it's pretty hard. When my son went to army, a lot of people said, oh, your son is an Asian. How can he go to army? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a self-doubting. I don't want my community, young people to have that self-doubt about themselves, that they are not enough and they can't do something. I want everyone to have equal opportunity and have the potential to serve in the whatever skills and talents that they bring in.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know, earlier we talked a little bit about immigration and things that, you know, people think it's a recent thing, like, oh, now suddenly there's people from other cultures here. But it's like people have been here for 200 years. They've been part of the fabric of this society for so long. What was it like when we look back at history, sort of these immigration exclusionary laws, and how did that impact the community?
Absolutely. I can talk about that. So just to give you a little bit of statistics and different migration patterns. So Chinese immigration started in 1948, and that was mainly brought in here to work in gold mines and railroad construction. However, at that time, you know, at one point, you know, they said only men can come and women cannot come. So that is the one thing. But at one point, if, for example, in 1910, annually 100,000 and more Chinese were coming. But then in early 19th century, were brought in here to work in plantations. And then Japanese and Filipino came also in a different different migrations. But what really happened, and I want to highlight this exclusion law that in particularly for Chinese community, they went through a Chinese exclusion law in 1882, and they prohibited Chinese immigration suddenly. And then they were not even given all the rights as citizens. They were actually segregated and they're kept in one corner. And that is the history why we have even Chinatowns today. So a few years back, somebody said, hey, you know, we need a Chinatown in Indianapolis. And I said, no, Chinatown do not, it's a very organically grown community. So that happened. But at the same time, in right around the World War II, we had this the camps created for Japanese, and, you know, actually there was a real animosity between Chinese and Japanese community. And they were kind of kept put up against both of them. And there were actual literature shared with people that how to differentiate a Chinese from Japanese. And at that point in the mid, I'm talking about the mid 19th century, when, you know, right around the World War II, now Chinese were favored. And then the Japanese were put in those camps, you know, detention camps, and they were kept separate, like even those who are American citizens. Mm-hmm. So it is that kind of a history we are sitting. Like, you know, if you reflect back, that's the history we have. And a lot of hate crimes that we see now has a lot to do what has happened, you know, in past probably 100 years right. and the laws and some of the laws that have actually, we still have that hate and this discrimination going on.
Mm-hmm. So when we talk about immigration, what was the main reason why folks were immigrating to the United States?
They all have come with different reasons. So, like, you know, Chinese came during the gold rush era versus after 1965, when we wanted to build this whole highway network, you know, U.S. has actually gone around the world and recruited immigrants. For example, lots of universities went around and recruited students from Asia. Currently, we are getting $3.9 billion revenue just from the foreign students. So it has got a lot of economic impact on our society. And that's one of the reasons why we see so many immigrant students also coming here. But then in 1995, we had another surge of immigrants from some of the countries to help with the Y2K problem, because, you know, we have this huge challenge in front of us. So I think there has been different phases of immigration, I look at it. And that is where I feel U.S. has built this bilateral relationship with different countries, India, China, Philippines, and all the countries, I can say, to solve a specific problem of United States. So I look at it as a very much like a collaborative thing. And it's not just like, you know, everybody from Asia was trying to just come here, you know?
Right.
So I want to just demystify that one thing that, you know, it's not something people were, and they were not able to come also. Like I came here as an, with my spouse, he was H-1B, I being a biomedical engineer, I was not allowed to work here. And once we come here, particularly for India, China, and Philippines, we cannot get our citizenship for 20 years.
Wow.
So everyone is in a different category. We are not monolithic because we are 48 plus countries. So our immigration laws are sometimes different for different countries also, based on the number of quota that we get from anywhere from working visa to the family-based visa versus green cards. And it's not just the same for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Before we go to the break in just a minute, I'd like to talk a little bit more about your story. I mean, you came here. Did you feel like you faced anything that was, I guess, not what you expected? So maybe you had this idea you're going to come here, and then you found out that people here were just not being nice, for lack of a better term.
I would say I was just looking at one of the data, and 80% of the Asians feel that they have been discriminated at some point. And I was not excluded either. I would just say that when my son was young and he was taking Indian meal to the school, and somebody made fun of him that, you know, your salsa looks yucky, and he stopped eating that. So that's the one example. But then I have also seen in a workplace, and that's again model minority myth, that you want Asian Americans to do mid-management roles. And I was told that, you know, you look like a soccer mom and you can't be a manager.
Wow.
So.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely pick back up on this when we come back after a quick break. We're talking about Asian American history. After the break, we'll hear more stories about the Asian experience in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about the historic and unique experiences of the Asian community in Indiana as part of Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. With us is Rupal Thanawala, the president of the Asian American Alliance. Rupal, I want to ask you a little bit more. You know, you mentioned that you've faced this idea of the model minority, and that's one of the biggest stereotypes out there. Can you tell us a little bit about why this is such a detrimental stereotype that we really need to get rid of?
Because number one, you know, it really limits people to grow. And at the same time, those who are not having, first of all, everyone brings different skills and talents and gifts. So we cannot have everyone to just go in tech or STEM careers. We have amongst us some of the greatest artists, some of the greatest writers, and we want to promote everyone equally and also, you know, bring out the best from everyone. Mm-hmm. It also creates a certain level of pressure amongst people to always keep working harder and harder and not getting, and they have been held at a different, at a higher level. That means an Asian has to work harder to achieve promotion or get a certain level of recognition than their peers. Mm-hmm. So it is a very unfair treatment. At the same time, we also face something called reverse discrimination when it comes to the college admissions. So that means there is a certain quota system. And they said, you know, it's, for example, an Asian American, I'm coming up with a number, can have a 1500 SAT score. However, their peer may be accepted at 1400 score. What it does is that they also limit the number of Asians they want to be admitted. So another Asian at 1450 SAT score may not even get admitted. Mm-hmm. So it really limits our growth in the school systems. And at the same time, even at the in a workplace, you know, we have been again looked as mid-management people and not offered leadership positions. So it's, there's a common saying that, you know, Asians cannot get a corner office in the building, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they also say that Asian Americans are very polite, law-abiding group, who have achieved a higher level, so probably they don't need a lot of help. However, we have communities from all over the Asia, and not everybody has been provided similar opportunities. To give an example, Indiana has probably anywhere from 20,000 to 30,000 Burmese refugees who have come from Myanmar here, and many of them could not speak English when they come here, so they had to learn English. They didn't have the cars, and they were not at the same financial level than some of the Asians who have been here for 50, 60 years and have well settled here. So mm-hmm. just because we put everyone at the same level, like my Burmese community members were not getting the benefits of the system. And in fact, you know, they were held at a different standard than they deserve to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, how does one address sort of this kind of sentiment when it's discrimination, stereotypes? What is being done to change that?
So one of the things we have been working very actively is working with all the way up to the state department, city, state, and even corporations. It's more about the education, speaking out as much as we can, like how, you know, you have given us an opportunity because there's a lack of education about this topic, number one, but also making sure that, you know, we have opportunities created for them. So, for example, Burmese community, there were, I think that's the first organization that I can remember who got a grant from United Way of Central Indiana last year. So having them even the funding that they deserve to uplift their communities. I've also heard that, you know, Kroger has, for example, created specific opportunities for in their warehouse in Shelbyville to give jobs to Burmese community. So I think working with community together and creating opportunities for everyone is very critical.
Mm-hmm. And how does the Asian American community look like in Indiana right now? Is it growing? Are there you mentioned there's some movement, it seems like, to recognize some of the organizations. Do you see it getting better?
Yeah, so it's definitely getting better. I would say that in the last 25 years in Indiana, Asian community has grown almost by 49%. And that is first due to, you know, this migration for technology and STEM careers, that they got special visa permit in 1995. So that's there you see, you know, a pocket of a lot of Asian Americans in Lilly and tech community where the scientists and technologists came, but then the refugees also came. And when community became more and more integrated, then a lot of people started coming to Indianapolis for different reasons. So we have around 170,000 Asian Americans in Indiana. And we have three major communities here, Chinese, Indian, and Burmese, probably 30,000-35,000 each, I would say. But then I also want to highlight that Japanese companies have been providing employment to more than 75,000 Hoosiers also here, because between Toyota, Honda, Subaru, and Nissan, they are making investments also here. So they not only bring their Japanese employees here, but then they're also creating job opportunities. And so it's a classic example of Infosys. So it's not only just the communities growing, but then there is also a bilateral economic development activities that are also happening. What I heard just on a Friday that India and Indiana, I'm just saying specific numbers, between India and Indiana, we have a trade going off for $1.2 billion. And export to China from Indiana is, I think, more than $3 to $4 billion a year. So I also want people to appreciate that as much as you see Asians around in town, working next to you in your offices, we are also helping grow the economic ties between Indiana and our Asian countries.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the takeaways that you're hoping that people learn or you know, make different in their life from Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month?
So the takeaways I would say is it's very simple, that accept your Asian American friends as Americans. This, we are all from one human race. I think that is a very simple one takeaway I want everyone to have, because what violence we have seen in past few months and in even last 15 to 16 months that I have seen has made Asian community very comfortable. We want to feel safe and respected. That's the least we are asking at this point. And having your fellow Hoosiers, give them the opportunity that they deserve. Because we have to stop this cycle of violence and hate crimes. I think that is our number one priority for this year during this Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. Because I want my friends from Pakistan who could be wearing a hijab and walking in the street, and they should be safe. My Sikh brothers and sisters, they wear turban. That's not make them a terrorist. I wear my bindi, and if I wear my Indian outfit and I walk, I should be freely able to walk into a grocery store, and I should not be feeling uncomfortable that, hey, I need to remove. And I do that. I remove my bindi the moment I step into a store, and probably I wear it other times, you know. Mm-hmm. So having people, that acceptance is critical in the time where we are having such a high number of hate crimes in the community. I've raised my family here for the last 25 years. I really want to encourage more and more people to come here, because Indiana is one of the very welcoming and a very homely place, a very good place to raise your family. And some factors that we are seeing right now should not have been here.
Right, right. Well, I appreciate you.
I hope it's not a lot to ask for, right?
No, I mean, I honestly, I feel sad that people still have to say we're American, you know? I mean, it's really unfortunate that we still live in these times, and hopefully things can improve. You know, I'm also curious, you know, what you mentioned, some of these recent incidents, you know, these hate crimes that have happened. Do you feel that part of that was due to sort of the political climate, or do you feel that it's just, I guess what I'm wondering is it changing? Is it getting better? Or is there still a lot of fear and people on edge?
So it did start with some of the political messaging last year, I would say, because we heard a lot of comments from my, when I say Asian friends, but from my East Asian community, that is, you know, Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Filipino community, that they were called, you know, Chinese virus. And particularly, as spoken in my earlier segment on in this episode, that a lot of Chinese and Vietnamese business owners, you know, saw the decline in their business. They were not able to. People said, I cannot even eat a Chinese food, to the point, you know, people thought they'll get a, you know, COVID virus from them. So that has happened. But then we almost took, I don't think so, it's getting better. Let me put it this way. Because we have not even reached, we have not reached a 1 month mark to, you know, the funeral of our friends who lost their loved ones in FedEx shooting. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say it's getting better.
Right.
We are still healing. We are still mourning. What happened in Atlanta is just 2 month-old story. So I would say that, yes, it's not getting better. However, I'm very, very appreciative of our community members and a lot of friends who have shared their sympathy, condolences, help, support. So we are grateful. But at the same time, we don't know what is still, you know, brewing in people's mind and what can happen next. So, yes, we are under still a lot of fear.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's something that we're just going to have to, I guess, keep an eye on and work together as a community and make sure that everybody feels safe and welcome.
Yeah, and I'm very grateful to our law enforcement agencies like FBI, IMPD. They all have been very vigilant now about and, you know, tracking those individuals who could be, you know, potential, you know, threat to us. So they have been made aware and they have been working very hard with our community to make sure that, you know, we feel safe. But it's just, you just need a one person, again, having a gun in their hand and they can do it. Mm-hmm. So I'm very vocal about, you know, our gun laws and, you know, the background checks, what we need. And, you know, yeah, we have lots of loopholes and that's why these things are happening.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing with us and being so open. We really appreciate your time and we wish you a wonderful Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. And hopefully we'll check in again and have a more positive, uplifting time to talk. And hopefully these things will be behind us. We really appreciate it. Rupal Thanawala is the president of the Asian American Alliance. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll
Thank
move
you
on
very
now
much.
To our next segment. We have Nicole Martinez-Legrand, the Multicultural Collections Coordinator for the Indiana Historical Society. Thank you so much for joining us today, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the stories you have to share with us today, I want to ask how you got into researching the Asian experiences in Indiana in the first place.
Well, in 2016, the Indiana Historical Society received a grant to look at the state's two largest populations, the history of them, Asian and Latino. And so since the Indiana Historical Society has been around since 1830, you know, these were the biggest noticeable gaps in our historical narrative. So they hired me to begin to working on traveling the state, making relationships with individuals, groups, businesses, and organizations to help collect that history.
Awesome. Well, so tell us a bit about this Be Heard Asian Experiences in Indiana exhibit the Indiana Historical Society held a couple of years back.
So, in 2019, let me back up. So the primary way in which I would collect history was conducting audio recorded oral history interviews. So preserving history in their own words of their own community and their own Indiana experience. And so we selected about 10 out of the 20, almost 25 plus interviews. And those were put in audio clips to talk about Indiana. At that time, I think it was displaying almost 115 years of Asian history in Indiana. And so looking at the different populations, giving more information about their culture, heritage, and what does that look like here in the Hoosier States? So, you know, who's here and what does their history look like?
Mm-hmm. And what did you find when this was all being collected?
So I have found many different interesting stories, and really as Rupal had talked about earlier, you know, people think this is, you know, the Asian community is a new Hoosier community, and that could be, you know, far from it. And so doing all of this research, you know that the history here has lasted just as long as some of our other immigrant populations here in Indiana. So, you know, they have existed and flourished alongside, you know, German Americans, you know, Eastern Europeans, Latinos. And so all these really interesting histories intersect. But I think the word is that this is not a new Hoosier community. They've been here for, the Asians have been here and contributing to the state of Indiana for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I don't know what the reason is, but it just seems that we hear about other cultural heritage in the U.S., as you mentioned, you know, German, European, but mm-hmm. the Asian experience is often left out. And I'm just curious, I don't know if you have the answer to that, but why that is.
You know, that is a really good question. And I don't think there's any kind of singular answer. I know for like the Latino side, you know, it wasn't until like the 1960s and, you know, I think the civil rights era that was kind of bringing this community forward. But really, you know, there hasn't really been that kind of, and this is just speculation, but there really hasn't been that like nationwide, you know, push for, you know, to see and be seen. I mean, there definitely was, you know, a moment in, you know, out on California and out the West Coast about Asian, it's called the Yellow Power Movement, you know, talking about their own identity. And a lot of these were Japanese American children whose parents were incarcerated in the war relocation camps, Japanese concentration camps during World War II. So there's not really a one great singular answer, but we're here celebrating it now. So I have a feeling that this is going to be a continued conversation in the future.
Absolutely. And why do you think exhibits like this are important for Indiana?
I think it's very important just to know that the diversity that has existed here for generations, and also to learn more about the contributions of these individuals and how we all benefit from them, not just the Asian community. Things don't happen necessarily in a silo. And then also just to kind of give a rich, a richer story of what a Hoosier is. In 2017, Indiana passed the Ethnic Studies Bill, prompting Indiana high school student teachers to teach other history. So by bringing these stories, we're actually giving more content to high school students or just school teachers here in Indiana to learn more about Asians and...
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely want to talk more and really get into some of the stories that you were able to cover. We'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about the stories and history of the Asian American community in Indiana with Nicole Martinez-Legrand, the Multicultural Collections Coordinator for the Indiana Historical Society. If you have any questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the stories and history of the Asian community in Indiana with Nicole Martinez-Legrand, the Multicultural Collections Coordinator for the Indiana Historical Society. Before the break, Nicole, we briefly touched on wanting to talk about some of these stories, so I really do want to get into that. There are a few stories you have to share with us today, one of them being about a Chinese-American restaurant called the Bamboo Inn.
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. So the Bamboo Inn began in 1918 here in Indianapolis, Indiana, on Monument Circle in what was known as the Circle Theater Building, which is now known as the Hilbert Circle Theater Building, where the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra plays. They were not the first Chinese-American restaurant in Indianapolis, but the first one in prime real estate. So if anybody who has been in Indianapolis knows that Monument Circle is a high traffic area and, great visibility, what a realtor would call prime real estate, right? So while doing some research on some other things, I came across a 1926 photo of the Circle Theater Building. And what really struck me was I saw, it was in the evening, I saw a lit up sign on the perched on top of the building that said Chop Suey, and a two-story storefront that was opulently decorated in, I guess what you would say, Chinese like a Chinese facade building. And so just learning more about the history of this building, it began in 1918. It was kind of the place to see and be seen serving Chinese American food. It existed until 1961, but looking at the research of this building, changing ownership, people who worked there, things that they saw, being in the forefront of history, it was just a really interesting history to uncover. And we have so many photos of it, and it just has never been brought to light before.
That's interesting. Even with all these photographic pieces, people still don't really know about it. Why was the location of this restaurant so significant?
Well, I think one, again, right being there on the Circle Theater, especially the time in which they existed. So they started in 1918 and they existed vibrantly, visibly at the time when the Klan was at its height here in Indiana. And so I think that speaks to the testament of the Asian community here in Indiana in their history. They weren't just kind of existing in the shadows. They were, right there, in prime time, existing among all the other nationalities of Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned this was like a place to, I don't know, was it to see and be seen and hang
yes.
out?
Yeah. So when I, doing research, newspaper research and trying to find some information about the restaurant, you find a lot of notices of, people having luncheons there, high profile people eating there, talking about, this politician, you know, came into town this day, and, you know, here are the number of things that he did. And, oh, by the way, he had lunch at the Bamboo Inn. So we definitely, in terms of newspaper research, we're not short on mentions, but it was just, you know, they covered it so well. But yeah, again, it was just, you know, a place to, you know, see and be seen. And they had a floor, they had music entertainment evening. And then in the 1930s, they opened up the second floor, which also existed, but it opened up as a nightclub, a 250 person capacity nightclub. They did midnight shows, and they call them floor shows, from Thursday to Sunday.
Mm-hmm. And what about the menu offerings there? It seemed pretty interesting, the stuff that I saw.
Yeah, so I found, I think it was an 1820 menu. So they talked about having, you know, chop suey, which is a Chinese American dish. If you went to China and asked for chop suey, they would, you know, would not know what you were talking about. But they had a really mixed fare. So they would serve American dishes as well. They would serve like lobster, oysters, queen sea turtle soup, filet mignon, you know, all your prime things that you would see on nice restaurants here in Indianapolis, chicken and steak dinners. One of the most peculiar things was egg lemonade, which was, it is what it is. It's an egg and lemonade mixed together, which is a popular digestive at that time. So something you would probably eat to settle your dinner.
Right. And I don't know if I remember this correctly, but I think the article that I read that you might have written mentioned that they got in trouble for some of the food that they were serving.
Yes, there was, you know, really before the FDA formally existed, this is based off of speculation, they were given an impure meat charge where a waiter was charged and served time for impure meat. So you notice a lot of Chinese American restaurants around this time, even the early 1900s, you know, not just in Indianapolis, would always advertise, our kitchens are clean, you know, you can come in at any time to take, you know, take a look and see how we prepare, you know, these wonderful meals. And so I think that's evidence of some racism that they've had experienced at one time. So, you know, the Bamboo Inn was not immune to that. And it was also very successful. So it was also a target of a lot of robberies.
Wow. So they had some success and some setbacks. Was there anything surprising you found in your research on this restaurant?
I'm trying to think of what was most interesting. I think that the menu was probably the most interesting, but really thinking about like long-term, you know, what was the history that they were experiencing being there? So they would see the end of, you know, World War One, and so we know that the Circle is a focal point of celebration here in the city. So they would have the front row seat to that. They would also see Carol Lombard, who was a famous Hollywood actress, you know, be here in the 1940s, you know, for the, I think it was called the Back the Attack War Bond Drive, and she would get on a plane and perish shortly thereafter. So they would see Carol Lombard and all these people and Indianapolis notables raising funds, and they raised funds themselves. They raised what would be the equivalent of $29,000 for the war bond drive. And so not only they were just, you know, they were really part of the Indianapolis community. And then, yeah, so they would see the end of two major world wars. So I think that's pretty interesting of the history, you know, being in that location, what they would have seen on a daily basis.
Right, right. It's very fascinating. What about when we think about Asian American communities in the United States? A lot of times we tend to think of people living and working in California on the West Coast, but we do have significant populations here in Indiana. Why Indiana?
You know, I think it's you know, it depends on what you, time period of history that you're looking at. I think, you know, as Intercontinental Railroad was completed, or the Transcontinental Railroad was completed, they, you know, looking for different places to work. So looking at, you know, immigrant labor, there were different kind of what they would call labor agents or labor organizations that would say, you know, I need 500 men, you know, come here. And then also people who would, you know, visit Indianapolis or visit in different parts of Indiana and would find that it's, you know, it's a nice place to settle down. And so they would, you know, settle down here for a little while and either A, move on, or, you know, truly become a part of the community.
Mm-hmm. Another really interesting story that I saw that you'd written about was, aside from the Bamboo Inn, was a soy sauce company that was in Columbia City back in the 1900s, I think. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, the Shoyu sauce of Columbia City. So Columbia City is near Fort Wayne, Indiana, in Whitley County. A man by Shinzo Oki would come to Indiana by way of the travels of a couple that was probably from that area, and would bring him here. And he'd go to high school in Columbia City in the 1910s. And so, once he graduated, he would, stick around in that area. And he became kind of like a lecturer about Japanese culture in that area. And so there are newspaper accounts of him giving a stereograph, which kind of like, I don't know, for your viewers of a certain age, kind of like a viewfinder of the early 1900s, showing, what Japan looked like. And then he would move to Detroit and work as an importer, and later Chicago. But then he would return to Columbia City to open up a soy sauce factory. So he actually went back to Japan to learn how to make soy sauce. And the company would actually start in Chicago, but then he would relocate it and it would flourish here in Columbia City. In Indiana, and he would operate that up almost until I think his death in the 1960s. So it got bought out by Beatrice Foods, which is a part of a larger food group that we know as ConAgra. So, I never walk down a grocery aisle and look at soy sauce and not think, especially ConAgra brand, and wonder, I'm like, is that Shinzo's recipe? We'll never know. But yeah, he was also a major employer for that town as well.
Yeah, that's such an interesting story, because now that after knowing about it, now I'm going to think the same thing when I'm looking at things in the grocery aisle. What's the history mm-hmm. behind it? I think we mentioned this briefly. RuPaul mentioned it in the other segment about when we think about Chinatown or Japantown or things like that in different areas. She mentioned that it was the result of policies against these communities that formed these cities. So when people mm-hmm. ask, like, why isn't there one in Indiana, is that maybe not a good question to ask? Like, is it the result of something negative?
I think in some instances, in terms of settlement patterns and discrimination, I don't think it's necessarily a thing. I think it's a good question to ask. Asking why is never a bad thing, right? Asking why leads you to understand what else is happening. It leads you to think of the bigger picture, but in terms of Indianapolis and having why we don't have a Chinatown, because people do ask that a lot, we kind of did of some sort. So we did have a small population of Chinese businessmen here in Indiana who were primarily, importers or laundrymen, and most notably Moy Ki, who was a notable here in Indiana. And so he, he came here in the 1890s, so I think 1897, but he was kind of like an early civil rights activist in terms of, the Chinese Exclusion Act. He was in Chicago and he would repeatedly try to earn his naturalization and petition for that, because he was here before in the United States, before the Chinese Exclusion Act. And the Marion County Circus Court actually accepted and granted him a citizenship, which would have been later rescinded in the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm. And so is there, maybe a change in culture now where people, they enjoy other cultural experiences. And so they're like, yeah, we want a Chinatown in Indiana. Or is that something that would happen naturally?
I think in terms of settlement patterns and looking at why those Chinatowns had settled, like in major U.S. cities like Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, I think it's a different kind of question, right? And so those were kind of forced exclusions, forced kind of what we think of like as redlining today. You cannot live in this part of town because you are of this kind of cultural background. And so I think if, for people to form a Chinatown today, I think that would be more of like a commercial venture, but it's not necessarily like an appropriate, they're not mutually exclusive. They're not the same.
Right. Well, I'll say I learned something new. I didn't even realize that this was part of the history. So thank you so much for sharing that, and RuPaul as well for telling us about that earlier. What can you tell us about the impact the Asian community has had on Indiana and its history?
I think it's just adding more diversity. As we are bringing these narratives to light through the Be Heard exhibit, I think people are just now realizing that, Indiana isn't as, what it means to be Hoosier. Truly, I mean, how diverse it is, how many different ethnicities that make up, you know, Indiana and the Indiana experience. And more importantly, to understand, you know, not only just the culture, but the contributions of these, you know, individuals, cultural backgrounds and people of this culture living here, you know, how we make it, you know, how they've made Indiana a better place. RuPaul gave a really good example about all of these, you know, international businesses that we have here with, you know, Subaru and Nissan and all these, you know, these are Japanese people making an investment into Indiana and not only just providing opportunities for their community, but, you know, all Hoosiers as well. So I think that is indicative of, you know, of changing times and just people really truly understanding this long history and what it means.
Mm-hmm. And when it comes to oral history, I know it's very important to keep stories and experiences alive. Mm-hmm. What's the importance when it comes to the Asian American community and oral history?
I think, you know, oral history, storytelling, regardless of your cultural background, is important. That's how you preserve your own family history. And so I think by preserving these, the audio and the transcripts and the history that's been compiled around them are going to be invaluable. Not only just are they now, but in 100 years when people are trying to truly understand, you know, the Hoosier experience here in Indiana. You know, I ask people a lot of, you know, what was your life like before you came in Indiana, or, you know, or what was it like to grow up here in Indiana? And so providing all these different perspectives is just going to be something. Or there's oral history is history, and it's just a really interesting way to learn about history through the lived experiences of individuals, of, you know, families. It's such an invaluable tool.
Yeah, and I find it fascinating to hear oral histories because you feel like you're experiencing their story with them.
Exactly. And so I provide a lot of the historical context around it so that if somebody is picking up these transcripts in the next 5, 10, 50, 100 years, the context of what they're speaking about is going to be very clear to them and to the reader. So, mm-hmm. And also, you know, how cool is it going to be to, you know, discover your own family or relatives audio recording to hear their voice? I know that there are a lot of things that, you know, I wish I could hear, you know, history told by my great-great-grandparents. I would love to hear what they sounded like. And so I think that's another kind of hidden benefit or jewel in terms of contributing your oral history here in Indiana, or to the Indiana Historical Society.
Right. Well, we have about a minute and a half left. I do want to see if you can tell us real quick about the 1983 movie A Christmas Story and how that relates to everything.
Yeah, so one, I am a native of Hammond, Indiana, and so that's where that story takes place. Gene Shepherd is a native of that area, and he talked about, you know, the Christmas Story is a compilation of different essays about his growing up in home and fictional home in Indiana. And so the Cam Land restaurant that existed in downtown Hammond was a Chinese, also a Chinese American restaurant that started in the late 1930s and existed, I think, under different ownership, I think up until like maybe their, I want to say maybe the 90s or early 2000s, but the family that ran it were well known and well respected. And it was actually right by Hammond High, which Gene Shepherd went to school. And so given how popular that restaurant was, it was kind of, you know, putting two and two together. But in terms of the depiction in the movie, is a little inaccurate. So, you know, Charles Tsang, who was the proprietor, you know, wore a three-piece suit, and there were booths instead of tables. And so, and his wait staff were a mix of, you know, Asian and Caucasian people. So I think the depiction in the movie is a little stereotypical and inaccurate.
Mm-hmm. But I guess the whole story stems from Indiana. So there's a little bit of an Indiana tie there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. Nicole Martinez-Legrand is the Multicultural Collections Coordinator for the Indiana Historical Society. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brooks. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow to learn about the middle class in Indiana. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soap. Thanks for listening. This is All In.